From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. 33 House Democrats joined Republicans in late May 2018 to pass a bill that chipped away at the Dodd-Frank financial regulations. The bill frees small and medium-sized banks from the regulations that were put into place to prevent future recessions. Critics warn that the bill is the beginning of the end of Dodd-Frank and makes future recessions like the 2008 crash more likely. Well, that great recession of 2008 sent the global economy into a tailspin and caused the lives of countless ordinary people to be upended. But major central banks and global financial institutions like the IMF were left more powerful than ever. A new book tells the sordid tale of how that happened. Its author is Nomi Prince. She's a former investment banker at Goldman Sachs, Bear Stearns, and Lehman Brothers. She has written several books. Her earlier books include All the President's Bankers, The Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power, as well as Other People's Money, The Corporate Mugging of America. And she now joins me to discuss this latest book called Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World. Welcome to the show, Nomi Prince.
Thank you.
So before we get into a discussion of your book, I'm wondering what you make of this recent vote by the House with 33 Democrats joining Republicans to pass this bill that chipped away at the Dodd-Frank regulations. People are calling this a compromise. Do you think that it is?
Well, I think Dodd-Frank was already a compromise. I mean, I think Dodd-Frank should have been Glass-Steagall reinstatement, which would have avoided a lot of these problems, because then small banks would have done what they do and big banks would have had less capital to be involved with that was tied to deposits and loans, and things would have just been better off. That said, Dodd-Frank did create the Consumer Financial Protection Board. It did create a situation where big banks and medium-sized banks hopped up living wills to determine how they would act in the event of an emergency financial crisis, so as not to depend again on the taxpayer or the Federal Reserve for the consistent subsidies they've been receiving from these entities. And those were the parts that were repealed. The idea of reserving a certain amount of capital was dialed back as well. And that's a problem because it was positioned as a means to help smaller banks and community banks. The reality is, what will happen is if smaller banks and community banks have less regulations, and frankly, they don't do a lot of the esoteric speculative stuff to begin with. So the regulations that were associated with those types of activities were meaningless. But what will happen is that because they have less restrictions, big banks will simply buy them, as they've been doing over the last 10 years and even before that, and sort of buy up their lack of restriction and just continue to amass the sort of deposits and assets connected to their speculative activities that they have done for the last 10 years in reward effectively for the crisis they created 10 years ago.
Now, let's go to the recession of 2007-2008 and look at what happened, not specifically or in detail in the U.S. Much has been written about that, but globally, which is the focus of your book. The title of your book, Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World. When you say central bankers, what do you mean by that?
So the individuals that run the central banks throughout the world, I mean, at the time of the financial crisis, it was Ben Bernanke in the United States. It subsequently was Janet Yellen and now Jerome Powell.
So the Federal Reserve is considered America's central bank, and a lot of nations have their own central banks, right?
That's correct. And it's very simple, even if we don't think about central banks and generally to understand what that means. A central bank is a bank for banks. It is a bank that is able to monitor and change the value of money, interest rates that banks get, especially the bigger banks, not the smaller banks. They get the best money at the best rates from the central bank when they need it. Or even if they don't need it, they're now getting it at cheaper rates because of the ongoing 10-year policy of central banks at keeping rates cheap. Central banks have also manufactured, conjured money to buy assets from banks in the wake of the financial crisis to give them money to use as however they want to use it, and to continue that process as they've been doing for the last 10 years, though they said it was an emergency. Central banks are the parent to banks. They are the lender of last resort. They are the emergency lender. They are supposed to monitor how banks operate. They're supposed to be regulators, but they have this ability to fix problems by throwing money at them in unlimited means, in unlimited ways, when things go wrong, which is what we've seen in unprecedented amounts over the last 10 years.
Right. Here in the United States, the Federal Reserve sets interest rates, right? And so since the recession, the interest rate, the base interest rate has been essentially pegged to nearly zero. Big banks have, of course, benefited from that. And this whole idea of too big to fail was linked to that as well, right?
Right. When you're too big to fail, it means that in order to keep you from failing, there have to be remedies or subsidies thrown at you. And the big banks, in particular the big six banks in the United States, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, Chase, Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, and Goldman Sachs, were the recipients of that insurance against them having to fail. And that insurance came in the form of a taxpayer-supported bailout, which was small in the scheme of what they've received since, of $700 billion in 2008, and multi-trillions of dollars, $4.5 trillion from the Fed, and multiple trillions around the world to help subsidize a codependent banking system that emanates from the big six banks on Wall Street and in the United States that has been going on for 10 years. So too big to fail means you get a life raft when you need it, and that life raft is thrown out to you by the Fed, and the Fed chooses, by how it's constructed, who gets the life raft and who doesn't. And the life raft goes to the big banks. It's like the Titanic. The life rafts went to the rich people. They did not go to the people in steerage class.
Did central banks of major economies around the world do something similar in their economies to what the Federal Reserve did in the U.S.?
Yes, it was the Federal Reserve, and this is why I talk about it as being collusion, a collusive effort. The Federal Reserve couldn't do it alone for two reasons. One is the mess that the U.S. banks had made in the world, in the U.S., was just simply too big for one central bank to clean up, and banks in general at that level are codependent. Your community bank isn't codependent with a community bank in some suburb of Berlin in Germany. However, J.P. Morgan Chase is very codependent with Deutsche Bank. That's just how our global financial system operates. So when money needed to be manufactured and rates needed to be set to zero so that there could be enough availability of funds cheaply to our banks and the banks with whom they had operations and deals throughout the world, the Fed could not do it alone. The second reason they couldn't do it alone is because the dollar, the U.S. dollar, which is the reserve currency, it's the one that is most in use amongst all of the central banks throughout the world, was required to help this emergency for other countries. They needed dollars to operate. And in order to manufacture dollars, there had to be a cheapening of rates and so forth. And the Fed had to require other major central banks to get involved in what is now a 10-year policy of producing money, conjuring money, to help continue to subsidize its banking system.
Right, fabricated money. You specifically focus on a number of banks, one of them being Mexico's central bank. What role did that bank play?
Well, the way in which I focus on different banks in different countries that I travel to and analyze them and research throughout this book is how they were caught or how they participated in the collusion. So in the case of Mexico, they had a situation where their economy was doing quite well, growing, and inequality was shrinking and so forth into our financial crisis. And all of a sudden our financial crisis hits. At first they think, okay, well, what happens on Wall Street stays on Wall Street. That's not going to impact us. That changed very, very quickly and dramatically for them. And so the head of the central bank of Mexico at the time, Guillermo Ortiz, he basically had been through a prior financial crisis in Mexico in 1994, the peso crisis, the restructuring of the banking system there and all that, the pain that was associated with that at the time. He was involved with that. And now as the leader of the Central Bank of Mexico, he actually came to visit Ben Bernanke, who was the chair of our central bank, the Fed. And he said, look, you know, I think I know what you're going to do. And I'm going to tell you right now, you're going to basically push the problem down the road. You need to create confidence amongst the people in the banking system, not necessarily just in the banks amongst themselves. And this process, this cheap money and so forth, is going to have major ramifications in the future. And Ben Bernanke pretty much ignored him. He even ignored him to the point where he didn't even include him in the memoirs, this warning. And subsequently, Ortiz went around the world and talked about how the regulators had been asleep at the wheel with respect to derivatives into the financial crisis, the Fed itself, and so forth. And he ultimately was asked or sort of leaned upon to reduce rates to the extent, not to zero, but in a manner, sort of proportional to what the Fed was doing. And he didn't necessarily want to do that to the same level, because that would have ultimately an inflationary effect on Mexico and on the Mexico people and on prices. They would have to pay for things. But he was replaced as the head of the central bank for not really towing the line of the Fed by a man named Augustin Carstens later on in the 10-year process. And Carstens very much supported Ben Bernanke and started being a cheerleader. And so in this way, Mexico is brought into the fold until Carstens himself started to see that there could be problems in this policy many years down the line, and started criticizing the Fed, and ultimately left his post as central bank leader early to go and run the Bank of International Settlements, which is the central bank of central banks, which itself, located in Europe, is criticizing this entire experiment.
I want to turn to some of the large economies of the global south. Brazil, India, China, they have sort of over the past several years realized that it doesn't bode well for them to have their economy so deeply tied to that of the West, to that of the US in particular, and they formed this banking alliance, this financial alliance called the BRICS Alliance. Tell us a little bit about how these countries and their economies, even though these are developing nations, they are huge economies, and how they colluded or didn't in the rigging of the global economy.
Well, they didn't have the same role in the sort of core of rigging the global economy that the Fed had, that the European Central Bank had, and the Bank of Japan had, and to a lesser extent, the Bank of England, Canada, National Swiss Bank, and so forth, being as sort of the core actors in producing zero interest rates and continuing to conjure money to buy the assets in different ways in different countries, in different regions. The BRICS nations decided in the wake of the financial crisis, for multiple reasons, because A, they didn't want to necessarily just be exposed to the dollar, because they really envisioned this financial crisis as being a big deal. And the way in which the Fed handled it and the United States government handled it, which was, you know, subsidizing the banks as opposed to restructuring or reforming them, caused them some concern, and some countries were more vocal than other countries. One of the heads of the Central Bank of Brazil over the 10 years was the one who coined, for example, the term helicopter Ben, to basically, you know, give us a visual on how Ben Bernanke, the chair of the Fed, was sort of creating money in the sky and sprinkling it on his friends in the big banks and not going anywhere else. And it was somehow supposed to, fuel the main economies. But in the growing economies of the these BRICS nations, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, there were some real problems. And they didn't want to see themselves forever being attached or so codependent on the dollar and on the U.S. And so they started forming their own alliances. A new development bank arose. It's headquartered in Shanghai. I visited with some of the leaders there in research for this book. And one of the reasons for that, the new development bank, or the BRICS bank, was, for example, to have a development bank outside of the main dollar-dependent structures of the IMF or the World Bank, whereby they could decide how money was used and how trade alliances worked amongst themselves and their sort of companion countries that were growing in their various regions, as a kind of anecdote to what they saw happening in the U.S. So it's very economically and monetarily based. Obviously, there's political ramifications and everything, but it came out of a real concern, which accelerated their movement to have their own alliances anyway, but it really accelerated that movement.
Let's talk about Europe. In the years leading, the years after the great, the global recession, we saw European leaders choose austerity policies. We've seen growing inequality in Europe, with some exceptions. I mean, there's some countries that are doing better than others, you know, the Greece versus Germany, for example. But what specific ways did central banks in Europe and the European Union, European Central Bank, rather, take on policies or adopt policies that really quite predictably led to the economic inequality Europeans are struggling with today.
Yeah, so again, that was an example of the original central bank leader, Jean-Claude Trichet, who was there when the crisis started and who chose to, at first, go against the Fed and against what Ben Bernanke had wanted to do in sort of cheap money with cheap money policy. And he actually raised rates in Europe to basically deal with the economies there. He was kind of reprimanded in the central bank community for doing that. Ultimately, he was replaced by Mario Draghi, who's the current head of the European Central Bank, who made a lot of decisions and had a lot of power to create money and decide where it went. So, for example, it didn't go to Greece and it didn't go to Italy, and it went to corporations in Germany and in Holland and in Luxembourg, because that was what the ECB decided was the most important beneficiary of its money fabrication scheme. And as a result, of course, you create even more inequality, because you have this inequality kind of propensity to begin with amongst the different economies in Europe that was inherent going into the financial crisis. But then a crisis hits and capital tends to flow out of the periphery countries, out of the weaker countries, into the stronger ones at first anyway. And then you have this European Central Bank, which manufactures even more capital out of nowhere to go and do those same things. And that's how you manifest even more inequality, economic instability for people. You change voter preferences because they're disillusioned with their leaders, because you had almost $5 trillion worth of money conjured in the last 10 years, most of it under Mario Draghi's leadership at the European Central Bank, going to the stronger countries and going to the stronger companies, which just by definition is going to exacerbate inequality.
Right. So essentially a crash that was largely the doing of these big institutions, out of the wreckage of that crash came policies that ended up strengthening those same big institutions, which in turn is only going to lead to the inevitability of another, perhaps greater crash.
That's exactly right. And when you say it like that, and you know, that you're summarizing a lot of the themes in my book so well, Sonali, you just wonder what they're thinking. And the answer is they were thinking about protecting the system. They were thinking about protecting all those large institutions in the stronger countries with money that they manufactured with no limitation and no accountability, no transparency, no auditing, in order to do just that. And so there's no way that you end up with a sort of high growth or economic stability result amongst the populations in any country in the world, because this wasn't just a collusive policy amongst the larger banks. It was also other smaller central banks had to be reactive to it. You know, all of a sudden, they don't have the same cheap money to go into their financial system. They're more reliant on more speculative capital coming into their countries. That speculative capital, which basically is created cheaply, goes and looks for higher returns in their countries, and it leaves just as quickly, if not more so, than it came in, hurting them even more so. So it really wrecked a lot of the future of a lot of the world. Right now, on the surface, though, they can turn around and say, yeah, but I mean, economies are doing okay, banks are stronger, stock markets are up, and it's like they're unaware that's only because a whole pile of money has been created out of nowhere in order to just manifest that situation. Growth, however, for example, in the major economies has been under 2% on average per year for the past 10 years. It just simply hasn't stimulated growth in any meaningful way or in any sort of real productive measure. It's literally just gone into financial assets and into speculative bubbles. And these people that run these institutions don't seem to have an exit plan beyond saying that it's working and hoping. And I think they all get out of their leadership positions before things crash around them. And they sort of like keep this snowball rolling up the hill as long as they're in power. And, you know, when it starts to go down, or if it starts to go down really quickly later, they're somewhere else.
Now, what about the major global financial institutions like the IMF? You write in your book a lot about the International Monetary Fund, which was an institution that was way back when created with the very noble and lofty sounding goal of wanting to end inequality on a global scale, but then became very notorious for their harsh cookie cutter structural adjustment policies that small and poor countries had to you know, were forced into sort of undermining their social institutions in order to pay off deep debts. And then the IMF sort of fell off the stage when the anti-globalization movement kind of won that ideological battle. What did the IMF do in the years after the 2008 recession? Did it sort of play ball with all of these central bankers as well?
Yeah, it's really interesting. The IMF has, on some accords, really stayed with that mission of putting structural adjustment or austerity types of programs as contingencies for loans that they would provide to certain developing nations or, you know, to certain developing nation projects and that sort of thing. And to a large extent, that has continued over the last 10 years. But also, I think there are people at the IMF, including Christine Lagarde, who runs the IMF now, who are looking at the possibility of all the debt that's been created, for example, because of these cheap money policies, because of the collusion of the major central banks by these developing nations, by the emerging market countries, and saying, you know what, there could be some greater problems here. And she, a couple of years ago, started to sound the whistle on those and has continued to, as have some of the researchers at the IMF. It's always very interesting to me that there's the sort of policy side of the IMF and then there's the sort of people who are saying, yeah, but if you do this, it's going to create more inequality. If you do this, it's going to create more economic hardship. And so there's this weird sort of dichotomy of information that comes out of there. But it's interesting that over the last few years, the IMF has really been critical of the Fed's policy in terms of the quantitative easing and where that can lead if it goes wrong, if these countries can't repay the debt that they've taken out in order to sort of keep up with the cheap money both available and just that other countries were using and the speculative capital that came into their countries that can go out. So it's kind of, there's a little bit more complexity, I think, that's entered the IMF in the wake of these particular policies that have been pushed by the Federal Reserve.
So moving forward, when you obviously the economic policies impact political realities on the ground, as you alluded to in Europe, and more people are waking up to how the current system just isn't working for them. They see it in their day-to-day lives, but the you know, there's this huge sort of rift between an ever decreasing number of people who have more and more of the money and the large mass of ordinary people around the world who don't. The question is, I'm wondering if you've seen the political trend go, unfortunately, in the wrong direction rather than in a direction to hold these big bankers accountable. It seems as though economic populism has gone rightward, which is exactly in line with what the big banks want, rather than go leftward, which could actually have held big banks accountable.
Yeah, it really has happened. I mean, you look at our country, our elections of Donald Trump, the Brexit vote in the UK, the movement to the right, and actually the far left in Italy, the movement to the right in Germany. And I think a lot of that is simply because the parties that have been in power weren't getting it. And I think that
the liberal parties, right?
Right. And I think the not getting it, when I say that, I mean, they weren't punishing the banks enough. They weren't reforming enough. They weren't, you know, even noticing or mentioning what central banks were doing to subsidize this entire very rigged financial system against main people. And so I think individuals are sitting there saying, look, market's up. I'm supposed to feel really good, but I'm just not. I don't have enough money in my bank account. I've got no interest coming in on my savings, if I even have savings. I have to take on more debt myself in order to keep up with just average expenses. And I'm looking at reports from my politicians and, you know, in the sort of main media or whoever, the market analysts saying that everything is great and I should be happy, and I'm just not. And so the natural thing for anyone to do is to look outward to from the status quo and say, okay, well, who's going to say something that I can hold on to? And what's happening, I think, with a lot of these shifts in voter preferences in the wake of this economic stability is that they're saying, all right, well, these people are promising that, you know, it's I can be helped, that it's not necessarily the fault of banks. It's the fault of immigrants or refugees or whatever. And I can, or Mexicans, if you're in the US or whatever it might be. And I can kind of understand that, you know, central bank, no one's saying that. I don't even know what that is, but I can understand that there is a policy, or at least I'm being told there's a policy that's keeping me back And the people coming in who are talking about this policy keeping me back that say that they have a way of solving that. And that becomes very potent to a voter if they feel economic anxiety that the party in power is not acknowledging. Whoever that party is, in this case, it was liberals and Democrats who basically look at the U.S. I mean, this entire quantitative easing policy manifested under President Obama and his Treasury Department has multiple times through multiple years and leaders said that everything is fine. The banks are healthy. It'll never happen again. And when people are hearing that, they're a little disillusioned because they're saying, you know what? I don't know if I believe that.
Well, certainly we have a crisis in leadership. Nomi Prinz, it's always a pleasure to have you on. I'm sure we'll have you back on in the near future. Good luck with the book and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Sonali.
My guest is Nomi Prinz, a former investment banker at Goldman Sachs, Bear Stearns, and Lehman Brothers. Her earlier books include All the President's Bankers and Other People's Money. We've been discussing her newest book, Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.